in Colorado tonight. And coming up on Sunday in the NFL, the Packers take on the New York Jets in a noon game. Bears play the San Francisco 49ers in the 3:05 game. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Friday, the 21st. Should be a cloudy and windy day. Seasonal temperatures, a high of 37. A little bit later on, winds up to 20 miles per hour. And a quick note, winter officially arrives at 4:23 this afternoon. Right now, wind from the northwest at 8, 32 degrees, Racine 33 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:11, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information available at carthage.edu/admission/transfer. Support also comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Information at jackandrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show. I'm Gregory Berg. On a number of occasions, I've had the great pleasure of interviewing Ken Wheely, one of the most highly regarded music educators here in southeastern Wisconsin for many, many years, a very, very fine band director in the Kenosha Unified School District, but recently retired. Ken Wheely not only is a talented musician, but also a talented photographer. And for very personal reasons that we will get to shortly, he has put together a breathtakingly beautiful book called Musings, which features his photographs and the poetry of his late mother, Marguerite Wheely. And so this book called Musings is the topic of part one of today's morning show. And we're going to explore what this project meant to Ken and the particular place where these beautiful photographs were taken. And we're actually going to also hear the voice of Ken's mother, Marguerite, reciting several of her poems. So we have a lot to do. Ken Wheely, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thanks so much, Greg. It's an honor to be here.
It's always been fun to talk to you over the years. And let me just ask you first real quick, how does retirement feel for someone who was such a devoted teacher for so many years? Does this feel okay?
Well, I've got to be honest, you know, my wife was really worried about it. She thought I was just going to have a really tough time. But photography has been the thing for me. And, of course, taking care of my mom, those two things have been the way for me to get, get adjusted. But I just miss the kids. We talked a little bit beforehand, and I just miss the kids so much. That's the hardest part about being retired. You know, the music making was extraordinary and fun. I was so honored to have a chance to work with wonderful kids. But it's really, you know, those personal connections with the kids that I miss the most. And luckily, a lot of them have reached out in the last few months to check in on me and see how I'm doing. Worried about me, you know. So it's been nice that way, but I definitely miss teaching.
Well, I'm sure they miss you as every bit as much as you miss them. But onward and upward, life has new chapters, and this is yours now. And you were telling me that this project, this beautiful book called Musings, was something you wanted to put together in part because of having just lost your mom. In fact, you were saying just about a month ago.
Right.
So, first of all, tell us about your mom, Marguerite Wheely, and then something about this final chapter of her life that you ultimately got to spend with her, thanks to being retired.
Well, one of the things that happened immediately after she passed away, as we were doing the estate sale, you know, going through all the memorabilia and all the keepsakes that were in the home, and it was a mixture of, you know, as you know, the laughter and the tears all kind of going together as we would pore over these old photographs and these reminiscences that my mom and dad had put in this, all the spots in the house with things that they loved the most. And a lot of those ended up being newspaper clippings from my dad's triumphant moments in his career.
He was an educator.
He was a band director, too, right? And then, of course, my mom's writings, which my dad had diligently kind of set aside and put together this wonderful anthology of her poems. He really celebrated her work as an artist, you know, being married to a band director. She wrote down, I think as part of her trying to publish her poems, she wrote down a really short biography. And I think this really sums up who Mom was. She wrote very succinctly, married to a music man, mother of four, all music teachers, grandmother of six, heading the same way, loves music, reading, cooking, gardening, and people. And, you know, it was remarkable. All of us four kids ended up somehow, you know, we all became music teachers. And I know she was inordinately proud of that, you know, but taking care of us and taking care of my dad, you know, as she supported his career was just, I don't know how she did it.
Right.
I don't know how she did it. And along the way, Greg, she was creating this wonderful poetry. Unbeknownst to me, and quite frankly, when she would talk about her poems when I was in high school or college, I would just, you know, politely say, oh, that sounds wonderful, Mom, you know, but I hadn't really lived enough to understand and appreciate the things that she was writing about.
Wow. You know? So this, it sounds like this was something she did quietly, although not exactly privately. It's not like she never mentioned this or shut this away from you, but she didn't make a big deal about it.
No. And I know that it was one of the sacrifices she made. My dad got his undergraduate and master's degree from Michigan, and so, you know, she made huge sacrifices, kind of set aside her own career. I know she would have been a remarkable teacher. I think that was probably the thing that she would have done if she had had a career. But she set aside all that to take care of my dad and, of course, to raise a family. Right. And but along the way, she wrote these remarkable poems. And these poems have so much to do, number one, with her faith, you know, as a Lutheran, and then her absolute love of nature and the beauty of the North Woods of the Upper Peninsula. She just loved being outside. I remember taking her for walks after my dad died, and we'd walk along the shores of Lake Superior, and she'd just keep saying, this is where I feel most at home. This is where I belong. And she just reveled in the beauty of the North Woods. And she wrote some just extraordinary poems about that love and that appreciation she had for that part of the country.
So is that where you grew up?
Yes.
So yeah. that's where you lived your whole life.
Right. And it was an unusual, now looking back, of course, looking back on it, because my dad instilled in us this love for music and this absolutely joy of being in that surroundings, of being in the North Woods. I mean, those two kind of worked hand in hand. And, you know, that was one of the things I, and I wanted to share with you, as I was going through her things, she had put together just a couple of memoirs from when she was the, her mom and dad were Norwegian immigrants, and she talks about her early years. And if I could just share a couple things about that.
Sure.
I think it's kind of interesting. She said, some of my first memories are of the thunder of my mom's heartbeat as she held me close, going to sleep in strange bedrooms, hearing the murmur of my parents and friends' voices as they visited and played cards, and being waked up by sudden bursts of laughter, then drifting off to sleep again. being roused and carried home piggyback by my father across moonlit fields.
Mm.
I remember real candles on the Christmas tree at Sunday school. Someone with a wet sponge and a bucket kept watch, extinguishing the ones that were burnt too close.
Wow.
Right? And she talks about, I remember my parents moving to North Dakota. Their original name was actually Frosland. Frosland. I'm not sure how to say that in Norsky, but she said there were so many Froslands in Iowa where they first settled, they changed their name to Olson. Hmm. So Grandma and Grandpa were Andrew and Olina Olson from Hauktivall, Sonja Ford, Norway.
That's so funny, to change your name to Olson so you have a name that sticks out. From Frostland, a name I've never heard in my life.
She said, I can well imagine Grandma being lonely for her beloved Norway in moving to such a different landscape from mountains and magnificence to the weather and wind of the North Dakota prairie. The contrast couldn't have been greater.
You know, that's really true, and I've never really stopped to think about that, how so many Norwegians settled in Iowa and North Dakota and South Dakota, and yes, how utterly different that would be, and it would just seem, at least at a glance, so empty and plain compared to Norway. I mean, it's beautiful in its own way, but not sort of in the spectacular way that Norway is beautiful.
I've
never stopped to think about that.
So
you grew up in the Upper Peninsula in a very, very loving home, and I suspect it was a relatively small school where you got to dabble in lots of different things. I remember you played basketball in high school, right? And I suspect your mother was supportive of everything that you and your siblings did.
Yeah. You know, I did a little bit of, well, first of all, I love reading your blog, The Messy Professor. It's one of the great things out there. If anybody of your listeners haven't had a chance to check that out, I mean, it's just a remarkable thing. And I happened to run across last night when I was kind of reminiscing about the things that you've written about, because your writing is just so good. I ran across the blog post that you made actually about your mom. It was Mother's Day a few years ago, and you had a wonderful reminiscence about the things that, well, the way that, what your mom meant to you. And, you know, there were a lot of similarities that came across. You know, both born in 1930.
Ah.
Right? And, and you had a quote in there that really struck me, and I wrote it down because it really kind of encapsulates how I felt after mom passed away. You said, "I lost a person who was more interested in me than anyone else."
Mm.
And that's you know, there's like that empty spot in you after you lose your mom. And I'm just lucky, and I just feel so blessed that, you know, I have this poetry as a way of sort of remembering her.
Yeah.
And your reminiscence really struck me because you had these vivid, I mean, she passed away relatively early, right? I mean,
right, yeah, it's 30 years ago.
30 years.
She was just 58.
But you wrote about her like it was just yesterday. I mean,
right.
The fact that she loved to play the cello and that she was loved to sing and and that she was so interested in your musicianship. I mean, just remarkable to me to hear about that. And it resonated with me because, you know, there's so many things that are parallel for me in the way I felt about my mom, of course. I think we're both in the same boat. They're very, very lucky.
Yeah,
have had, you know, someone like that to help guide us through those times in our life. We didn't know sometimes when you go through adolescence, if you don't know, you're on foot or horseback.
Sure.
You know.
Well, and you, you know, and you, to give you grounding and give you wings, as they sometimes say. I mean, to celebrate the great things you do and keep you humble when you you don't do so great or when you think you're too great or whatever. I mean, it's an indispensable role that they play for sure. So it sounds like your mom was a very, very special woman, and it's like you're realizing anew, even ways that you didn't realize at the time, just how special. And that's I don't think that's anything unique. I think most of us only
kind of go through that journey at different times,
Yeah, and we play catch up, realizing how special somebody was.
Yeah.
So you not only brought this beautiful book with you, but you also brought some recordings with you of your mom reciting her poetry. So when in the world and why were these recordings made?
Well, my son Ken was confirmed in ninth grade, and they would make the trek down here to be with us for that real important event, of course. And I had just the record. You know, she would go to the bookstore. That was the ritual. You know, she'd go to Barnes and Noble or get a big batch of books. And then come home, and we'd share and read and enjoy all the things that she'd. And I, you know, it just occurred to me, Mom, you know, I would love to have a recording of you, you know, reading some of your stuff. She had this way, and you hear it in the recording. She had a very musical way of reciting her poems. And as I started preparing for this talk with you today, I thought to myself, boy, the worst thing ever would be me trying to read through her poetry. It would be brutal. It would be brutal. And it just struck me, you know, I think I've got some recordings of her, of her reading it. So, yeah.
And how precious that you have these. Yeah. And, you know, who knows, maybe you have other remnants or artifacts of her voice, but not too many people can point to something like this and have this. So you've brought with you three different poems of her. And are these in the book?
Yes.
Okay. And one of them is called Red Leaf. Anything you want to say about this before we hear it?
Well, this is Mom's way of talking about the absolute glory of the fall colors in the Upper Peninsula once the leaves start to turn. I mean, it's actually, you can see from a satellite, you know, the reds and the incredible colors. And this was her way of talking about that. But it's also, she throws in the promise of spring, because in the Upper Peninsula, getting through the winter is absolutely an ordeal. You know, there's 5 solid months of snow and ice. And so you'll hear in part of the poems her reference to the promise of spring as well.
All right, so this is Red Leaf, and this is Marguerite Wheely reciting her poem.
A red leaf, signature of summer cease, nature casually tossing her glory. There's her golden scarf, her red cape on that chair over there. After all, the party's over, the music gone. Only the whisper of winter winds to come. Only the raucous squawk of blue jay and Johnny one note nuthatch ready with his encore. The rain in river's song muted to downy flake and kiss of skate. She sleeps and dreams in her immaculate innocence. When she wakes, rubbing her blue sky eyes and stretching her light-lifted limbs, we look and listen, watch for every sign, trembling with delight. There's the white throat tuning up. The ancient dance begins again.
That is really lovely poetry. And there is indeed a beautiful photograph on the opposite page with a crimson tree that is just beautiful. What can you tell us about when your mother developed this love of poetry and began writing it? I mean, is this something she did all of her life, or was this something that she came to later in life?
Well, I'm sure she was doing it all along. I really became aware of it. I was as a freshman in college at Lawrence University, and we had this remarkable course called Freshman Studies. It was, we all had to read the great works, you know, Plato's Republic, the Book of Genesis, Thomas Kuhn's Structure of Scientific Revolution, all these landmark things that, you know, the Lawrence folks thought we ought to know and be able to write about. And I would come home after taking these classes, and I happened to mention to Mom, you know, hey, I'm reading about, and she would be toe-to-toe with me right there. Wow. We'd be able to discuss in depth all these things that I was studying, and it just occurred to me that she was reading voraciously, and she was reading all the important things and the wonderful things.
Not just dumb little novels or
yes,
whatever.
Exactly.
I mean, not that novels are dumb, but
no,
but this was not just lightweight, casual reading.
Stuff of substance,
yeah.
And she just enjoyed those conversations I had so much, and she gloried in the fact that, you know, I was having the chance to study these things, and I think that, along with her love of being outdoors, really were the main influences. You know, she was able to reference so many great works of literature in her poetry, and I think that's really was the inspiration for that. And to be honest, too, I think it was a way for her to continue to create in the humdrum of trying to keep a family going and support a band director.
You know, I don't think a lot of people stop to think about that, especially if somebody's never tried to do any writing on their own. But I don't think a lot of people stop to think about how writing can be that. I mean, it can be, not that your mom didn't love her life and needed to escape from it.
Right.
But it's as though it is a pathway into more of life than is confined within those walls where you're doing all the vacuuming and cooking and cleaning and so on. So.
Yes, it was part of her, you know, being, finding her journey as an artist and feeding her soul, you know.
The second poem you've brought with us that she recites is a beautiful poem called Destiny. Anything you want to say about this?
Only that it was the poem that the pastor selected to read at Mom's funeral.
Wow. And you have, as the backdrop, the text of the poem is set against a beautiful photograph of a cloudy sky or a partly cloudy sky. It's lovely, both visually and the words themselves. And here they are, recited by the poet, Marguerite Wheely.
This one's called Destiny. Before whirling worlds were, before hand wrought or eye pierced the darkness, love was. Loving fatherhood called forth, without hands our form and being. We are destined to love and be loved, his hand guiding our way, his eye piercing our darkness, accepting his making, we are made.
It's very profound. I mean, you know, sometimes I mean this. This is amateur poetry in the best sense of the word, is done for the love of it. But a lot of times amateur poetry is not this good, you know, in terms of just its objective quality. This is beautifully written poetry. Is this something she studied?
It's not, though she had a remarkable English teacher in high school. And we found a lot of letters about the influence that her English teacher had on her. But you hear, Greg, in there this profound, rock-hard, you know, faith as, like, the foundation of her writing and you know, that Lutheran perspective is just a common thread that runs throughout the whole book, you know, that, and it's, you know, just hearing her read that again, to be honest with you, you know, I still get choked up, but... You know, it's just so much love and compassion and genuine, I don't know. She had a wonderful way of, you know, coming up with these quotes when we were growing up. And I wrote down just one I want to share with you really quick. She loved quoting Einstein.
How many people can say that about their mother? My mother loved to quote Einstein.
But she said, she'd always say to us, you know, when on these conversations I'd have on the phone or whatever, she'd always come up with this one. Here's the quote from Einstein. The most beautiful thing we can experience is the mysterious.
Oh.
And I just love that, you know. Wow. I just love that. I mean, and there's a poem in here that, not one that she read, but she talks about mystery as being sweet. And it's in regard to, you know, watching and seeing geese fly overhead and how we're bound to the earth and how the geese are flying up there and how there's that something mysterious about seeing a flock of geese. Well, maybe not in Wisconsin because they're all over the place, but in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, you know, that's her love of nature. And she always talked about the mysterious. She loved that quote, and she loved... she loved reading about nature, and you'll hear that coming through everything that she writes about.
Absolutely. Well, and I mean, I did not expect poems like the one we just heard, for instance. I thought they were all going to be about trees and lake shores and bird song and so on. And nothing, not that there's anything wrong with poems about that, but she goes well beyond that. That's for certainly true. If you don't mind, I want to read a poem that's caught my eye that is an example also of a poem that's about beautiful things around you, but it's an example of how a poem like that can be very, very deep. This is a poem called Full Circle. Is it okay if I read
it? Absolutely.
White hyacinths blooming by my back door, their sweet purity breathing holy incense from treasured stores. I bring some in, put them in a crystal vase, taking in their light and fragrance as I store truth and beauty for a colder day. The thing that I love about that, among many things, is that it's not just a poem about how pretty hyacinths are, but it really takes a moment to observe what we're doing when we take a hyacinth in and take it inside and want it with us for someday when the hyacinths won't be blooming anymore. And
right.
Very, very profound, beautiful, beautiful. So how many poems were there for you to look at and choose from in order to put this book together? I mean, does she have a treasure trove of hundreds, thousands? I mean,
you know, my dad, when he sort of typed them all up and put them in that keepsake place, there were about 30 or 40. And, you know, for me, in putting the book together, the process was finding the poems that inspired me to take a picture, find a picture that would somehow be a good, you know, accompaniment to her writing. And it was a great process for me to go out and look for all these spots in nature that sort of, you know, would accompany her writing. And there's one there that she talks about. It's titled Polyphony, and it's this imagery that she draws about a pine tree being reflected in the lake when the lake is perfectly calm. And she says, it's a liquid echo.
Mm.
And so the last line, the zinger is, how nice to see them twice.
Yeah, that's great.
And the remarkable thing about that, Greg, that was the last picture that I was struggling to find that spot, you know, to find that moment. In all my searchings, I couldn't find the picture or photograph. I couldn't capture the image that really encapsulated Mom's poem in the way I thought it should. And it wasn't until the day after we spread her ashes over the lake and in the where she grew up that I woke up one morning and I walked onto the lake shore, and there was that image right there.
Mm.
And I was able to take that picture of, it was just the most calm I've ever seen the lake that we live on. And it just presented itself, of course, at the right time.
Wow. And it is a beautiful picture. So it's some majestic pine trees right along the lake shore. And it looks like most of the trees behind it are bare. But there are these beautiful green pines, evergreens, right along the lake shore, perfectly reflected in the water. And then opposite it is this really beautiful poem called Polyphony. Holy spires of conifers rising to the skies from the dark and sacred sod reflect in the water. How nice to see them twice, a liquid echo. Hmm. And you know, one thing that I also want to say about your mom's poetry is, and I'm no expert, by the way, and I'm no poet, so both of those things need to be said, but it seems to me that a lot of times when somebody aspires to be a poet, one of the things they don't realize is that so often less is more. And I'm really struck by your mom's sense of reticence and understatement, and how many of these poems are relatively brief, and that's part of what makes them even lovelier than they would otherwise be. So,
well, I appreciate you noticing that. You know, it's that parallels between music and photography have always struck me, and music and poetry. And in photography, the one of the real challenges is in composition is to know what to leave out.
Yeah, and when to finish.
And when to finish.
Even Beethoven didn't always know when to finish. So,
right.
So I'm very, very impressed with that. One poem that also leaps out at me, and it's placed right beside a really lovely snow-filled winter scene, is a very brief poem called Seasons. In the silence of winter, we remember the sound of rain. I love the mystery that's part of that. It just gets you thinking and so on. I love imagining where your mom was.
Right.
Where
right.
was she in the house, or what was the day like when she found herself inspired to pen a little poem like that?
Yeah.
So were most of these photographs taken very recently and very purposefully for this book, or were some of them photographs that had already been taken that you, in a sense, repurposed?
Yeah, most of them were taken to create the project, and it was, as I shared with you when I got here before we went on the air, this process of grieving is real interesting. With my dad, the process took on the form of me throwing myself wholeheartedly and taking care of my mom and watching out for my mom and making many trips up north to be with her all by herself up there in the North Woods. And after mom passed away, the process of grieving took its form of, just throwing myself into something that I knew that she loved and appreciated. And it was just a labor of love, really, just going around and finding those pictures that I thought would fit.
Mm-hmm. You've done a wonderful job. One of the things I just wanted to ask is, sometimes when a project means this much to us, it makes it harder.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, like, there is this weight of momentousness.
Yes.
that can be really paralyzing if you're not careful, but it seems like this was not that.
It was easy, Greg. It was easy. And I was struck by this quote that she had written in her own. She wrote to this quote from John Keats, "If poetry does not come as easily as the leaves of a tree, it had better not come at all." and that's exactly, you overthink things when you're writing music, or if you overthink things when you're taking a picture, it's just kind of being, trusting your instincts and in being intuitive about that process, I think. And these photographs just came together so quickly, and you write about that. Sometimes you do feel that pressure, but in this case, it was exactly the opposite. It just sort of just all fell together so beautifully and so quickly.
I am impressed. We're going to finish out with your mother reciting her poem called Sing Spring, which says a lot about who she was and what was important to her.
This one's called Sing Spring. Sing spring, sing and sing and sing as the birds do. Sing the tender aspen branches bending under the weight of rich new green, bending under their weight of glory. Sing the bridal mistiness of blooming cherry and berry, choke cherry, pin cherry, elderberry. Who can name them all? Sing the hills sloping away, fettered with the triune lily, dazzling bright, dappling the dark woods. Sing the gentle knolls beside the road, graced with patches of the shy anemone, bending her head so modestly above her ruff of three. Sing the marsh marigolds, lighting the ditches in low places, reflecting back the sun of eons of time. Sing the fiddlehead ferns, uncurling to the silvery tuning note of spring peepers. And sing all the singers of spring, Emily, William, George, and the Shepherd King. It was not lost on them. It is never lost.
The beautiful poetry of Marguerite Wheely.
Signature of Summer
Cease.
The
photographs of Ken Wheely that can be found in this lovely book called Musings. And this book can be purchased through Amazon.com or through Blurb.com. Ken Wheely, I want to congratulate you on doing a beautiful job with this lovely, lovely book. I will treasure this copy that you've given to me, and I'm very, very happy that we had this opportunity to talk about it. Best wishes to you.
Thank you so much. I can't tell you how honored I am to be here talking with someone who I respect and admire so much as both a teacher and a musician and a creative artist. You're a force of nature, Greg, in our community, and to know that you're able to enjoy these poems, it meant so much to me.
Well, thank you again for being part of the morning show. This was a pleasure. Best wishes, Ken.
Thank you.
To finish out today's morning show, You're going to hear a conversation which I recorded with Ramsam Kasha, executive director of Betty Ford Hazelton Clinic in Chicago, about some of the special and difficult temptations that can be part of the holiday season for people who are already contending with issues of addiction. I have to say that when I received the email from your staff member, Rob Hahn, this had never dawned on me that this time of year could be especially dangerous for someone contending with one addiction or another. I've certainly done plenty of programs with therapists and so on how to contend with sort of the holiday blues or various things, and certainly done plenty of interviews on new ideas for Christmas cookies or whatever. But this really important topic had just never dawned on me. And the fact that it's never dawned on me means it's probably not dawned on a whole lot of people, and it makes this conversation even more important. When did it maybe first dawn on you that this is an especially dangerous time of year? I mean, is this something in which you just see that, for instance, in the lives of your clients at Hazelton?
Certainly. You know, that's something that comes up every time we come up to a holiday. There's something that occurs in every group that we run that's called planning, just planning session for the holidays. And it doesn't have to be something drastic. I mean, holiday blues are definitely a reality, but just the very basic stressors that come with holidays. You know, even long before you start feeling any form of depression or sadness, you know, you've got a lot of planning that's involved. You've got a lot of family that's involved, and with addiction, sometimes that family comes with feelings of shame or feelings of guilt, or at least a relationship that's been disrupted, and that just adds significantly to the stress. You want to also add to that a lot of holiday parties, whether they be work or family related, do have whether it's an open bar or drinks at the table, eggnog, you name it. You know, there's you've got the stress and you've got the triggers all combined.
Wow, that is a really dangerous situation, certainly. Let's begin with the person themselves who is, in a sense, especially vulnerable to such temptations entering this holiday season. What is your advice for such a person? What is going to make it most likely for them to, in a sense, survive the holidays unscathed in this respect?
Sure. You know, on a very basic level, one of the things that ties any kind of negative behavior, including the disease of addiction, is silence. You know, any kind of shame that leads somebody to close up, it just isolates a person. So the first thing that we would recommend is that the person in recovery or the person who's abusing alcohol, who's heading into the holidays, whether it be a party or just family, that they speak up. Speak up with their counselors if they're in programming. Speak up with their supports if they're in 12-step. Speak up with family. And now that doesn't necessarily mean that they have to put it on the Christmas cards and send it out to everybody. It doesn't have to be sharing everything with everybody. But at least identify one or maybe two people that will be at the event who are supports, who can be supports in that moment where you can tell them, this is what I'm going through, this is what my concerns are, and these are my goals. And that's the last part of it, is to establish actual goals of what you want to do. Have a plan so you don't go in thinking, oh, I'll just figure it out as I get there.
Right. And at least typically, I suppose this varies person to person, but at least typically, how would such a support person operate? What sorts of things might a support person do in such situations that are kind of fraught with that risk?
Well, it could go from a very high level of saying, you know what, I'm not going to drink either, and I'm going to be a support for you that way, and all the way to a very kind of quiet and reserved way of just having, whether it be a word or a catchphrase, to just basically knowing that there's somebody there helping me keep an eye on myself. You know, it doesn't have to be anything too belabored. It could simply just be, I know I have this person, and if I'm struggling or if they're seeing me struggle, they will approach me and just have a conversation with me, help me kind of take a second out of that runaway train that could be the craving, and really pull back and say, okay, what am I trying to do here? What's going on?
Hmm. By the way, I think we've really been kind of focusing our attention here on those for whom alcohol is the main issue, since alcohol sometimes flows very freely at the kind of holiday functions we're talking about. Do you also find yourself needing to help your clients who have different addictions that might also be sort of a heightened risk during this holiday season, even if it's not directly through, let's say, holiday parties at the office and so on?
Certainly. Although the actual substance being around may not be a trigger for other people who struggle with addiction to other drugs, the reality is there are still the stressors, there are still the triggers, and all they need is to get the chemical. And whatever that chemical is, it's really easy to obtain. Sadly, is what we've kind of found out. Anywhere you go, you can find whatever you're looking for. So similar things apply in terms of making sure you have a plan, making sure you have supports. For those that go to 12-step recovery, one thing we talk about is planning a phone call pre, middle, and post event, so that you've got set times where you're checking in with somebody. You know, keeping your recovery front of mind without having it dictate your daily life. The person is not going to sit there every second they're at a dinner party thinking, I have to stay sober. Because if they are, then it's not really a productive, healthy sobriety. But if they can have those touch points that can remind them that this is what I'm trying to do in a way that doesn't take over their lives the way the drug did in the act of addiction, that's what we really suggest and recommend, help our clients work with.
We're speaking with Ramson Kasha, who is executive director of the Chicago facility of Hazleton Betty Ford. And we're talking about some of the ways in which these holidays, whatever you are celebrating, can be an especially difficult time, challenging time for people who are dealing with some kind of addiction. And in particular, there is the reality that that alcohol tends to flow very freely during this season. And that in itself can be something of a trigger, coupled with the fact that often people are experiencing sort of heightened emotions and stresses and tension and maybe profound sense of loss and melancholy. And it can all add up to a real personal catastrophe for someone at a time that's supposed to be entirely joyous. That's why we're having this conversation. Ramson Kasha, I know that something else you want to say is that those of us for whom, you know, this is not an issue for ourselves, nevertheless should be trying to think about the ways in which we offer up hospitality and entertainment during the holidays that might inadvertently be leading someone into potential trouble. What are some of the ways in which we tend to kind of thoughtlessly create these kind of risks for other people?
Well, you know, one of the interesting things that we've seen over the last couple of years, and this isn't so much regarding family, but about the business holiday parties, we're seeing a lot of companies who maybe in the past had thrown more larger holiday parties where there was a lot more drinking involved, alcohol is more free-flowing. They've been dialing it back. You know, they'll have dinners or lunches, or they will have a shorter period of time for their parties, just because they want to, well, and on their end, minimize liability and also create a greater safety, because have been a lot of consequences coming out from those holiday parties, and not just for people who are alcoholics. You know, it's anybody who drinks may drink too much one night if they're not paying attention, and you know, that's all it really takes to lead to negative consequences. As for families, I think really one thing that has kind of shifted over time is we have gotten into a habit of at these parties having there be, you know, the mimosa with brunch and the toasts and eggnog, and alcohol has become part of the festivities, which, you know, is not necessarily something that's evil and horrible and we have to change, but I think we have to remind ourselves what's the main purpose of the festivity. It's not so much the toast, not so much even the food, it's the togetherness and really having the family members, having loved ones around, and I think that gets lost sometimes in just the whole setting up and establishing what are the events for the day and the preparation, we lose sight of this is what it's really about. And that by itself can help reduce some of the stress that comes along with setting up the perfect family holiday party. I think being, just in general, being more aware if there's a significant change in behavior in a family member, that's something. It doesn't necessarily mean they're an addict, but it's something that we have to look at. Holidays, for example, are another great time because we have a lot of emerging adults who are off at college, and this is, for a lot of them, the first time they come back. You know, a lot of things happen in first few months of college, and it's important for the family to be able to see who this person is walking in their door and, of course, be happy and be excited that they're home, but also just to be aware and not instantly just kind of write everything off as saying, oh, well, they're just stressed, but to actually have a conversation of saying, hey, what's going on? And that's literally all it takes. You don't have to know what are the signs and symptoms. You just have to be willing enough to have a real conversation with people when you see something is actually wrong.
Interesting. This is not a time for recipes, but I wonder if you could just say a word about any suggestions you might have for people who are interested in entertaining and who want to set a festive table without having that festive table be laden with temptations.
Sure. Yeah, the majority of the drinks that are connected with holidays have a non-alcoholic variety of them. You know, there's, eggnog is the one I keep mentioning, and you know, that's sold in stores all over the place in non-alcoholic variety. We could stray away from the mimosas and champagnes and go towards the non-alcoholic options, whether they be just standard orange juice at breakfast or non-alcoholic champagnes that exist out there. Non-alcoholic ciders as well. There are a lot of options. Apple cider, non-alcoholic, warmed up, that's a constant as well in holiday parties. There are so many options that are there that really don't cost more money. In fact, probably are less expensive. And we just don't consider them because we're not paying attention to this being a possibility that somebody may have an issue with alcohol. If we want to get a little more creative, there are a number of websites out there. I think even Martha Stewart has a website focusing on non-alcoholic holiday drinks. I mean, there are so many options and alternatives out there that all we have to do is literally take a look, and we'd be overwhelmed with the options that we have.
I'm just curious, does Hazleton Betty Ford, in a sense, stay in business every day of the year, including through the holidays? I ask because I sometimes wonder about people who find themselves stressed and tempted during this time of year and wonder about at least certain facilities or support groups or so on that might shut their doors for a week or two over the holidays and in a sense, leave people bereft of what might be help that they've depended on.
Well, yeah, I can tell you that Hazel and Betty Ford remains active. So there, you know, we've got two. To really simplify, we have two types of facilities. You know, in our Center City, Minnesota, and Rancho Mirage campuses, they're residential, and so that means that they are open with clinical programming every day of the year. You know, there's no day off from residential. Then we have a number of other programs, like here in Chicago, and our programs in New York, and some in California and Florida that are outpatient. Where we might not have the programming, might not have like the intensive outpatient treatment group meeting on that day, but there's still something going on. So I can speak for the Chicago campus very closely. One of the things that we do here is we do have like a halfway house on site that's fully staffed and that operates. There's programming in it. The programming shifts and becomes more, sharing meals together as opposed to doing groups and workshops together. So it is a little more interactive and a little more celebratory of the holidays. But one of the things that we feel very fortunate with, especially here at the Chicago campus, is we've got a vibrant alumni community. And every holiday, they organize what's called 12-step-a-thons. So basically Christmas Eve, New Year's Eve, and even Thanksgiving, from 5 p.m. in the eve to 5 p.m. the next day, there's a 12-step meeting happening every hour on the hour. And it's phenomenal. You know, I've heard that no matter what time the meeting, there's never been one where it's just one person. There's usually two, three, four, whether it's, you know, 3 in the morning, 4 in the morning, doesn't matter. People are looking for support. So we do try to provide it in some way.
Ramson.